Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Stanley Kubrick was born in 1928 and raised in a Jewish home in the Bronx. As he grew up, Stanley became obsessed with photography, chess, and more than anything else, movies. He discovered his eye for being a director while working as a photographer for Look magazine. Stanley's Jewishness played a part in his thinking of himself as an outsider. This could be the reason why his films stand apart from mainstream Hollywood fare and exist in their own decidedly Kubrickian cinematic world. David Mikix is the author of the propulsive biography, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. In his book, David explores the personal side of Kubrick's films. We zoomed in with David on a busy day in Brooklyn to learn about his grand unified theory about one of America's finest filmmakers.
The worlds of Kubrick's movies are about control. For example, you have, even early in his career, Paths of Glory from 1957 is a movie in which it's about World War I, and you have the generals in that movie who are manipulating, moving around the soldiers, forcing them to go into the trenches and to die en masse for seemingly absurd reasons. In Dr. Strangelove, you have the quite crazy idea of controlling the world, subjecting the world to a nuclear holocaust. You know, you have all these generals and nuclear theorists like Strangelove who are, thinking of the world as a kind of plaything. In The Shining, you have the hotel that controls Jack and his family. In Full Metal Jacket, you have the basic training segment at the beginning of that movie in which the raw recruits are reshaped into Marines through the most brutal kind of, controlling process. So I do think control is one of the basic aspects of these films.
You consider Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey to be the greatest film ever made. Why?
Good question. And part of it is just personal. I saw the movie at about age 13, 4 years or so after it was released, and I was just completely knocked out by it. I had never seen anything like this. It overwhelmed me. And of course, I saw it in 70 millimeter, where the image is just sort of something you immerse yourself in and you feel like you yourself are in outer space. So part of it was just the incredible impact it had on me. And the way in which it was really the first Hollywood movie that forced the audience to speculate. There is so much wonder in it. There are so many unanswered questions. The end of 2001 is something that no one will ever solve. People always ask, well, what does that ending mean? But it's utterly ambiguous. It is chilling, but it is also inspiring or thrilling. We don't know what will happen next. You see the star child looking at the Earth. Gazing out upon us, the audience too. And we really just don't know. So there's something sort of quasi-divine and shivery in that conclusion that always moved me. So yeah, the sheer otherworldliness of it, the difference of it, I think is what has always, made me respond. Definitely the best science fiction movie ever made and the most unusual one too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, you mentioned these questions that the film raises and questions which Kubrick doesn't answer, which add to the power of the film. Have you come up with any answers like to these questions about 2001?
I did come up with something, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. It's been a question for me a long time. Many times I've watched the movie and I've wondered, why does Hal suddenly freak out? What makes him lie? What makes him say that there's a malfunction in the spaceship when, in fact, there isn't? And I've traced that, I think, to a bit of dialogue between Dave the astronaut and Hal, in which Dave catches out Hal. He says to Hal, well, you're working up your crew psychology report. In other words, Hal is spying on the astronauts.
For instance, the way all our preparations were kept under such tight security, and the melodramatic touch of putting Doctors Hunter, Kimball, and Kaminsky aboard, already in hibernation after 4 months of separate training on their own.
You're working up your crew psychology report.
Of course I am. Sorry about this. I know it's a bit silly, Just a moment. Just a moment. I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35.
The moment Hal is shown up that way by Dave, I think Hal starts to feel like a human, like a person who has betrayed his friends, betrayed his comrades, and he reacts to that by doing still more of a betrayal. And eventually, of course, he starts killing the astronauts. So it's one of the main mysteries in the film. Why does Hal do this? And I think it has something to do with that conversation between him and Dave, in which Hal is revealed as a sort of traitor to the ship's crew.
Interesting. That's great that you came up with that, because I think you're right. That's very interesting. Let's fast forward about 22 years and talk about Kubrick's 1980 film, The Shining, which is an adaptation of Stephen King's novel of the same name. What was it about King's book that made Kubrick want to turn it into a film?
Well, Kubrick came across the book. He was sent the book, actually, by a Warner Brothers executive, a good friend of his named John Calley, big supporter of Kubrick's movies. And Kubrick thought, there really is something here, again, at the mythic level, at a deep primal level. And he said to himself, well, King's writing is sort of a mess. You know, there's an incredible amount of backstory here, a lot of information about Jack Torrance, how he was a school teacher in Vermont, an alcoholic, Jack's family, his relation between Jack and his father. All of this, Kubrick said to himself, all of this has to go. And Kubrick changed a lot of things in the book. But I think what he was looking for was something that is about the theme of family and about the theme of marriage. People don't often think of Kubrick as a filmmaker focused on marriage, but he really is. You look at some of his key movies, Barry Lyndon, The Shining, Eyes Wide Shut, all of those films are about marriage. So The Shining, of course, depicts a nightmare marriage, and it's about these themes of masculine rage, masculine revolt that had long preoccupied Kubrick. So if you look back to movies like Clockwork Orange, you know, you see that, or Dr. Strangelove. So I really do think that this material from King appealed to Kubrick at a very basic level.
Mm-hmm, very much so. Kubrick was notorious for making his actors and crew members do repeated retakes, and a great example is the scene between Jack Nicholson and Lloyd the bartender, which took more than 80 takes. You say this is one of Kubrick's greatest scenes. What's so great about it?
Oh, well, I've always just loved the scene. Joe Turkel, who plays the bartender, is a longtime actor in Kubrick's movies. He was in Paths of Glory, for example, in the 50s, many, many years before The Shining. And the way in which he seems like a sort of undead figure there, you know, the grim levity of Turkel in that scene as he responds to Jack.
How are things going, Mr. Torrance?
Things could be better, Lloyd. Things could be a whole lot better.
I hope it's nothing serious.
No. Nothing serious.
Women can't live with them, can't live without them.
Words of wisdom, Lloyd. Words of wisdom.
It's just terrifying, and it's terrifying also in a way that delights you somehow. You know, we're really responding to the sense of, you know, Jack is going into some new realm here. You know, he's being transported, he's being transformed into a monster. But it's a very recognizable monster, and it's really the height of Nicholson's acting, I think. You know, this, I think, is his best role in The Shining, where he really becomes this sort of big bad wolf figure. It's always knocked me out, that scene.
Do you think Kubrick had his actors and crew do so many takes on his movies because he genuinely needed all these takes, or was it just a way to show who was in charge?
That's a great question, Doug. And, you know, in the beginning and for many, many of his movies, it was, I think, almost always the case that he really needed all these takes. He'd like to look through the shots in the editing room and think very carefully about which one was preferable. And for that purpose, he needed a lot of takes. Matthew Modine, I don't quote this in the book because I have it secondhand, but apparently Matthew Modine said something, well, you know, something tends to happen around take 37, meaning that you really inhabit the words that you're saying. And this is why Kubrick did it. He wanted actors to really know the words. And he said disparagingly once, well, the problem with actors is that they don't really know the lines that they're reading. But after take 37, you do know those lines. Yeah. And a lot of the actors who worked with him and who were very happy working with him acknowledged this. And they didn't feel that it was a great burden to have so many takes. Now, there are some cases like Eyes Wide Shut, where reportedly he asked for 70 or 80 takes of Tom Cruise walking down a hallway. That's harder to defend. You know, that I think comes under the heading of obsessiveness. So on occasion, Kubrick did fall into that. But I think for the most part, the vast majority of these cases are cases where it really worked to his advantage. The actors knew what he was doing. They were quite willing to collaborate in that.
Let's talk about Full Metal Jacket, which was released in 1987. Why did Stanley Kubrick want to make this film?
He ran across a book by a guy named Gus Hasford called The Short Timers. And he knew that he wanted to make this into a movie. He had as a collaborator Michael Hare, who wrote one of the all-time best books about war called Dispatches, based on Michael Hare's experience as a journalist embedded with combat units in Vietnam. And so Kubrick had this in his mind for a long time, for years. But Oliver Stone was making Platoon at the same time. And this is a kind of unfortunate conjunction of the two movies, because Platoon did much better at the box office. Full Metal Jacket did fine, but nothing like Platoon. And in many ways, Platoon is a much more conventional movie. You know, it's about tragic catharsis. It's about heroism in a way that Full Metal Jacket isn't. Full Metal Jacket really sort of disorients you. It brutalizes you first, and then it disorients you. And that, I think, corresponds to the experience of Vietnam much more than Stone's movie does, even though Stone, of course, was in Vietnam and had a direct experience of a war that Kubrick didn't.
Mm-hmm. You say that structure is sometimes hard to see in the Vietnam section of Full Metal Jacket, and you describe the Vietnam section as drifting and episodic. But you also say that this was a deliberate decision that Kubrick made. How does this, so to speak, unstructured structure in the Vietnam section affect the viewer?
I think it disorients us. You know, the first 20 minutes of the movie is the basic training segment, and that is all about structure. I mean, it's structure rammed down your throat. You have these raw recruits, the maggots, as Hartman calls them, and he's turning them into killing machines. He's brutalizing them.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor. From now on, you will speak only when spoken to, and the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Sir, yes, sir!
If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You are the lowest form of life.
So that's structure. But after that, things become much more disconnected. The soldiers go to Vietnam, and they get caught up in the Tet Offensive. And nobody knows quite what is happening. This was one of the basic experiences in Vietnam, as you know, Doug, that you didn't know where the threat was going to come from. You didn't know what to do or where you were, really. You didn't even know what the point of the war was, often. So Kubrick is trying to convey all that in the remainder of the movie. He's really trying to get that across, and I think he does so very effectively. It's my favorite Vietnam movie, more so than Coppola's Apocalypse Now, which Kubrick also admired, by the way. He liked Coppola's movies quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. After Full Metal Jacket was released in 1979, Kubrick waited several years to make his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. Do you think it's a fitting end to his career?
I do think it's a fitting end to his career, although the first time I saw it, I was rather indifferent to it. Now I like it a lot, and I've seen it a number of times. But there are so many people who are sort of puzzled, they're kind of flummoxed and or bored or irritated by Eyes Wide Shut, that it's a movie that one feels one has to defend. But it's I do think it's a fitting end to Kubrick's career. The last moments of Eyes Wide Shut, that's exactly what he wanted to do in his final film. And of course, he died shortly after finishing the movie. He was on his last legs. He was actually sleeping with an oxygen tank in his bedroom as he finished the movie. So he knew it would be his last. And I do think he got what he wanted, and it's magnificent.
What is Stanley Kubrick's legacy?
Well, his legacy in part is this sort of hallucinatory or super lucid approach to filmmaking, in which everything is so crisp, so transparent, so clear, and so dreamlike. And we see that in some other filmmakers like Terrence Malick, for example, and Tarkovsky. You know, there are a number of movie makers who've been influenced by Kubrick. So he has had that influence. And in general, his influence as an example has been great. He was making some comments on a movie contract early in his career in the 1960s, and he said, I must have total, final, complete, annihilating control over the picture. Basically, he did this. You know, he was able to have the kind of control over his movies that very few filmmakers have accomplished in a Hollywood setting.
David Mikix, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
David Mikix is the author of Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. Find out more about David and Stanley Kubrick at wpr.org/beta.
I remembered that when I was younger, I always had this vision of myself as a true artist who, on his deathbed, would have all these regrets about the graphic novels that he didn't get to complete.
Cartoonist Adrian Tomina joins us to talk about his graphic memoir. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.